Thought Bubble Audio.
Look, up in the sky!
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Welcome to Beer with Geeks with Tim and Frank.
Who are you?
I'm Batman.
I am Iron Man.
Your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
My name is Inigo Montoya.
You're a wizard, Harry.
A couple of guys with a couple of beers and a whole lot of pop culture nostalgia.
Make it so, number one.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
Name the dog Indiana.
Life finds a way.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Now sit back and crack open a cold one. Because it's time for Beer with Geeks.
It comes in pints?
Shaken, not stirred.
Great Scott!
I was way off. I knew it started with an S, though.
Hi, and welcome to Beer with Geeks, the show where two geeks geek out with beer. I'm Frank. Tim is, well, we'll talk about Tim in a second, but joining me tonight...
Do we have to?
We'll see. Yeah, if we're good.
Okay.
Joining me today is friend of the show Scott from the Suicide Squadcast. Hey, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks
I
for joining me.
I was a little unprepared. I was like, oh, I'm on an actual Beer with Geeks episode. Just color me surprised.
Well, to that end, what are you drinking?
Oh my God, I feel so embarrassed.
Oh, why is that, Scott? Why are you embarrassed? Why?
Because the only beer I had in the fridge tonight was my wife's Coors Light, and so
womp,
that's what I'll be drinking tonight.
Well, I don't even know what's a what. Does it have a name? Does Coors Light have like a nickname?
Like, born in the Rockies.
I guess you've got that.
That's all you got.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because like you know with. You know, there's King of Beers, there's Champagne of Beers, and then I guess there's just Born in the Rockies. All right, we'll go with that. Is it one of those cold activated ones that you know the mountains turn blue when it's cold or whatever?
Yeah, actually, you're right.
Is it one of those?
It is.
All right,
it is one of those because it says cold lagered, cold filtered, cold packaged.
There you go. All right. So at least you got that going. Well. I am finishing up. It's late for this, but I'm still finishing up the last of my pumpkin beers.
Okay.
I picked some up on Halloween, and I've been sort of holding on to them, preciously. So the last one I'm finishing up here is a Cisco Brewers Pumple Drumpkin.
So does it vibe to alternate Earths?
Funny, Cisco. Actually, it's spelled like that too. It is an ale brewed with pumpkin and spices, and it's pretty, pretty darn good. From Nantucket here, up in New England. But Scott, we are here because you and I share a love for old musicals, right? Classic, classic Hollywood musicals and Broadway musicals, for that matter.
Oh yeah, trust me. When you guys start bursting out into song, it's just like I'm there singing along with you.
That's
it's
your
like,
jam.
That's my jam. And then when you make little puns, it's like, ooh, I feel like Cap in the first Avengers movie. I understood that reference.
Right. Exactly. And that's one thing that I've always enjoyed. You know, you and I have been friends on Twitter for a couple of years now. And one thing I've always noticed is like, hey, we have a similar sense of humor and we have like similar taste in movies and music and obviously we first met through sort of DC Comics fandom on Twitter. But I really have been wanting to talk about a movie for a long time now, a movie that has been a favorite of mine my entire life, and that is Yankee Doodle Dandy, starring...
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's a fantastic movie, starring James Cagney. Came out in 1942, at the height of World War II. It's been a... For most of my life, it's been my favorite movie. That's kind of come and gone over time, but I always come back around to it as a favorite. What's your exposure to this movie?
Okay, now this is the weird thing because I had a feeling you were going to ask me that, and so I started thinking about it. And the only way I can date myself is VHS.
Same, like, brother. Same.
That's I actually never owned a DVD of this movie. I owned it on VHS. I think what happened was I had a public library that I remember when I finally got to the ripe old age of like 13 or something, they would put a sticker on your library card and you could check out the movies by yourself without your parents having to check them out for you. And they had a section of just musicals, and I've been doing musical theater since I was 9. So I would just kind of flip through and just kind of go, oh, Dad's told me about that one. Dad's told me about that one. That one just looks good. I want to check that one out. And I had a proclivity for trying to find musicals that starred men. Because I grew up with Meet Me in St. Louis and Sound of Music and Annie Get Your Gun. And it was like...
It's female-led musicals.
Female-led musicals. And then I remember when I discovered The Music Man with Robert Preston. And I was like...
Yes.
And then I found Guys and Dolls. You know,
classic, yeah. Both of those classic.
So when I saw Yankee Doodle Dandy, and I see that starring Jimmy Cagney, who at that point, all I thought of was gangster movies.
Right.
And then I thought, he's in a musical?
This I got to see.
This I got to see. And then I'm watching it going, and he can dance?
Dude can dance. Yeah.
He can't really sing, but he can dance.
He can dance. Yeah, it's true. It's true. That's so funny. That's so funny because I also had a public library near me where I would go, you know, borrow VHS tapes like all the time. And I also had a love for The Music Man. I actually got to play the lead role when I was in middle school, which was really fun. So, yeah, I have a similar love for those things and for those kind of movies.
Oh, yeah. And so that just became – and also – tap dancing is hands down my favorite kind of dancing in any kind of musical. So, like, and the best thing is because I love old 30s and 40s, like the Gershwins, the Cole Porters, those kind of musicals. Well, those were the musicals that they all had tap numbers in.
Right,
them.
Of course.
So that's what also did. It was like I was never into the ballet or the sort of Fosse kind of dance stuff.
Yeah.
But you give me a musical with a tap number in it, and my butt's in the seat. And so that's what really appealed to me about this movie.
So are you more of a Fred Astaire guy than a Gene Kelly guy then?
No, I love them both equally. I really do. I kind of like Gene Kelly more only because, I'm going to be honest, when he dances, he looks like a guy when he dances.
Yeah, it's true. You
know, he's got that blue-collaredness that I could kind of emulate. I would never be as graceful as Fred Astaire was. And so I didn't discover Fred Astaire until almost like late high school, college. That's when I started watching stuff like Top Hat.
Interesting.
But Gene Kelly, I was singing in the rain from a young age. So nice, I was good to go.
All right. So you've got your pedigree, you got your bona fides there. I found Yankee Doodle Dandy at a very young age. I don't even remember. I must have been probably like 4 or 5. I was really young when I first saw it.
Wow.
It was also on VHS. My dad had recorded it off TV. He'd actually recorded it two separate times. My dad was the kind of guy who just was like, if his movie was on that he liked, or if a musician was going to be on a late night talk show that he liked, he would record everything. We had like, I don't exaggerate when I say hundreds of videotapes around the house full of little bits of things he'd recorded off TV just to sort of like, oh man, yeah, like Elvis Costello is going to be on Letterman tonight. Okay, I'm definitely recording that. And oh, Ringo is going to be on Johnny Carson. Great, I'm going to record that. So he would do that for all the time. And so sometimes we'd have duplicates of things without realizing it. So he'd record Yankee Doodle Dandy two different times, once the original black and white version and once a colorized version, which was actually a really good colorized version, which I watched the most.
Oh, really?
I watched that the most, but at a certain point, this is such a like 90s thing. At a certain point, the tape had been recorded over about 3/4 of the way through the film. So I would watch the colorized film, and then at the point at which it switched over to some other thing, I would stop the tape, pop in the black and white version, and finish the movie from there.
Oh, and you didn't take the tabs off the VHS. That was your mistake, right?
We
there.
Did after that. We did after that, but yeah. But yeah, it was a one-time mistake.
Anyone under the age of like 30 has
no idea what we're talking about at all. And they also don't know that once you took the tabs off, you could put some like scotch tape over it if you wanted to.
Yes!
Yeah, anyway. Such a lost thing. But anyhow, that was how I first saw this film, and I watched it to death. I did eventually own a DVD copy of it, but it unfortunately got lost. When I moved from New York to Boston, my movers lost a whole bunch of my DVDs from my DVD collection. That was one of them that went. But anyway, this is a very near and dear to my heart film. There's home movies of me, like, in my house at age, like, 6 and 7, singing songs from this movie and dancing around the house like a fool. So it really means a lot to me. It's the life story of renowned Broadway star and director and composer and
producer and owner and
everything.
He was called
mogul.
He was called the man who owned Broadway.
The man who owned Broadway, George M. Cohan. It's a biopic, and he's played by James Cagney. I saw this before I knew that Cagney was the gangster guy, right? Because I was so young. So to me, he is George M. Cohan. Like, that is that's the first thing that I knew him as, and you know, I'll always think of him as that. And it's this. For those who don't know, he started out in vaudeville. Cohan, that is, started out in vaudeville, and his family were a vaudeville family, and he grew up in show business, and then as Broadway kind of morphed to, you know, musicals as we know them today, he hit it really big, writing and starring in and producing and directing these musicals. And he wrote so much of early Broadway, what have really become standards and classics, and some songs that are sort of so standard and so classic and are now, you know, older and forgotten. But there are quite a few, like the title song Yankee Doodle Dandy and Give My Regards to Broadway and Over There. Grand Old Flag is probably the best known one, honestly. It's such a standard that it almost feels like a song that doesn't have a writer. You know, it just feels like it's just a song that's been around forever.
Well, that was the beauty of watching this movie, was going, he wrote that? He wrote that one too? He wrote that one too? It was almost an education of...
It is.
One man wrote all those songs?
Exactly. So it's a really fantastic, exciting movie, and a lot of fun, very patriotic. Remember, this was at in the height of World War II. It's the whole framing device for him telling his life story is that FDR calls him to the White House. And it's right around the time, and this was true, that Cohan was actually playing FDR on Broadway in a very satirical play where he was poking a lot of fun at the president. So he gets called to the White House, and he's like, oh my God, is it treason or something? Like, what did I do? Are they mad at me because, you know, they think that I'm like anti-US or whatever? And so he sits down with the president, and he's like, oh, I wanted to hear your life story, Mr. Cohan.
And a very cheesy FDR impersonation that actor, which I'm not sure if the actor's doing it, because you never see the actor's face.
I don't think he is. I think the actor, there's an actor who looks like him from behind, sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office, and then there's some other voice of like an impersonator who sounds, you know, kind of like a nasally, like, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, Mr. Cohan. You know, like that kind of a very cheesy sounding impersonation. And so he's like, oh, I remember it like it was yesterday. And it goes back to the beginning of his life, and he tells his whole life story, and all the songs are interwoven throughout, and it's an embellished version of his life, but it's
a very whitewashed version
very,
of his life as well.
Very, yes. It glosses over a lot of things, and you know, his two wives were combined into one woman who doesn't actually exist in real life, and all this kind of thing, but it's still, for what it, you know, for the product of his time, it's cheesy, over the top Americana, but damn it, I love it anyway.
I love it too. And the point is that it was 1942, so we had just joined the war,
right?
Like in less than a year.
Yes,
it was December 41 with Pearl Harbor. So it's really got that sense. I would call it propaganda if that didn't have such a negative connotation to it.
But it's technically textbook accurate, right? That it like the dictionary definition of propaganda. This is it. But yes, you're right. It has.
This
that
is go out and buy war bonds, and
yes,
join the
is.
Army, and,
exactly.
You know, be proud of your country, kind of movie.
Yes. Yes. If you buy the DVD, as a matter of fact, there's this really interesting thing on the DVD where they have, you know, back when this film came out, you'd pay your nickel or whatever to see a film, and you would get a cartoon, a live action short, and then the feature. And so it would be like an all day affair. I mean, it'd be like, you know, a 10-15 minute cartoon, a 20-30 minute short. So you're at 40 minutes right there.
And then a 2-hour movie.
And then a 2-hour movie. So it was a really, you know, you got a lot for your money. And on the DVD, they actually have like a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and then which is like a by War Bonds like cartoon of like Bugs Bunny fighting Nazis. And then a short about like a sort of dramatic short about fighter pilots, and then this movie. So it very much, oh, and a newsreel too. So it really put you in the place of like, wow, this is what people were watching. And it was all about the war effort and all about helping the war effort. And, you know, it really puts you in that time and place.
I want to say it's also on the blue. I own the Blu-ray now.
Oh, is it on the Blu-ray too?
Yeah, that was one of my deciding factors on getting the Blu-ray, is that I compare the special features between the two DVD disc release they put out, and then this Warner archive that you have to get, you know, online, and they carried over all the special features onto the Blu-ray.
Nice.
So you get all of that, and you only have to do it on one disc instead.
Nice. That's great. Yeah, that's awesome. It's a nice set. Like the content on it is really, really nice.
And especially if you're just an old Hollywood kind of person.
Yeah.
Like if you just love that whole, you get the experience, you get the documentaries, kind of that Turner Classic Movie feel.
It does. It does have that. Mm-hmm. Yes. So what is your favorite, if you can, what's your favorite number from this movie?
I, hands down, Give My Regards to Broadway.
Yes.
I'm not even saying it's my favorite song in the movie, but it's my favorite number in the movie, because it's the one where, you know, this is one of those biopics where all the musical numbers are done as if they're musical numbers. So
yes.
It's not like people are walking around in real life and bursting out with a song.
Oh, yeah, that's a good call out. Yeah, it's
every song is on stage,
yes,
being performed.
So you're watching Cagney as Cohan in character, like in his shows. You're watching vignettes that are like, oh, here's a scene from this show at the time in his life when he was performing in this show. So you're
right,
watching it from the audience, the Broadway audience's point of view.
With production values that Broadway would never have had, by the way.
Not in the 1910s, no.
No, not at all. So, yeah, so this is the one from Little Johnny Jones, mm-hmm, where he's playing a jockey who gets accused of throwing a race, because they give you enough of the musical number to get, like, the entire plot of the play, by the way.
Yeah.
And he's left alone on a pier, and he's kind of, you know, I don't understand exactly what the plot is, because that's not what matters. The matters is you could hear the songs. And what I love about Give My Regards to Broadway is, one, it's just a great song. It's got a beautiful melody. But then after he gets, quote, proven innocent, the musical number is just solo Cagney
tap dancing. Yeah.
The life out of him. And that's what I love about that number, is there's not all this other stuff going on. You know, kind of like Grand Ole Flag kind of seems to go on for a while. Give My Regards to Broadway is just put Cagney on stage and let the man just tap dance.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about Give My Regards to Broadway in the movie.
That's an excellent, excellent choice. It is such a good number. My favorite is probably the title number, Yankee Doodle Dandy, which happens just before the one you just mentioned.
Yeah, and we're still in Little Johnny Jones, actually.
It is. It's part of the same. You know,
show. Yeah.
But I love the whole watching the race happen. I think you mentioned it a minute ago. I think what I really love about it is that it summarizes the entire play. The entire musical in a 4 or 5 minute, you know, condensed version. So I really enjoy that, because you get the whole plot of like, okay, he shows up and he's an American jockey in London and he's going to try and win the Derby.
English Derby.
The Derby.
Cup.
Yes, yeah. The Derby, and they think that he threw the race when he lost, but he actually didn't, and then it goes into your number, Get Married, Go to Broadway, when he can't go back to the U.S., but he's like, oh, I'm staying here to whatever, I guess, be on trial or something. I can't go back.
It has something to do with the racing commission.
Yeah,
because
maybe that's what it is.
If they blacklist him, he can't go back and race, and if you're a jockey, that's kind of a big deal.
It's kind of the end of your career. Yeah,
yeah. But it's still a beautiful. It's one of those songs that I knew the song before I saw the movie. So it was one of those educations of, oh, he wrote that song. But, you know, you just get that beautiful, give my regards to Broadway. Remember me to Herald Square. Mm-hmm. Tell all the guys on 42nd Street that I will soon be there. I mean, it's just that beautiful lilting melody, which, granted, Cagney can't really sing. But it's still, when the whole chorus kind of gets into it.
Yes.
It just lilts.
It does.
And that's what makes it beautiful. And then you don't make Cagney sing, and you just let him dance.
Right.
And then it's just like, oh my goodness. I mean, we're talking someone on par with Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and later like Gregory Hines. And like these tap dancers who I just absolutely adore.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. He was a really, I mean, a very gifted dancer for somebody who was not, that wasn't his trade, you know? I mean, somebody who was a dramatic actor. It really, really is. It's a fantastic performance. And have you ever heard the actual George M. Cohan sing?
I'm going to say yes, but it has been so long ago, I couldn't tell you what he sounds like. I think I heard a little bit, because they did a Broadway musical with George M. with Joel Grey.
Yes.
And I think at some point on the cast album, they actually play a recording of George M. Cohan himself singing the songs.
Okay.
I think.
That could be. All I know is if you listen to the actual George M. Cohan sing, he's not as good as Cagney, I have to say.
Whoa,
he couldn't actually sing. He couldn't really actually, he basically did the talk singing that Cagney is doing. So Cagney is imitating the way Cohan would have sung it. In fact, a moment ago when you sang Give My Regards to Broadway right there, I can only hear it. Again, this is, you know, the first time I heard many of these songs, because I was so young when I first saw the film. I hear it in Cagney's voice, so I hear all the pauses and the choices he makes to the talk singing. Give my regards to Broadway. Like, all of that, I hear it in my head that way.
Yeah,
like, that
remember
is,
me to Herald Square.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when you hear, you know, the original recorded version of, I don't know, any song that's like that, any hit song, top 40 song from the radio, right, ever, some classic song, I don't know, Hotel California, whatever, you'll always hear the original recording in your head. And then if you hear a cover, or you hear that same band even do a live version, you're like, it's not quite the same, it's a little bit different.
No, and that's always the funny, like, when you hear the cover first and then you go hit the original.
Oh,
and
right.
You're like,
yeah, that always trips
no,
you out.
No, no, no,
right?
I need the cover. Right. It's always the first one you heard.
The first one you hear. Yeah, the first one you become familiar with, that's the one that sticks. And so for me, this is the first. These were the first versions of these songs in most cases, not like Grand Old Flag, obviously, but in many of these cases, the first times I heard these songs, so they are like the canonical versions to me. So, it's really funny how that works. And Cagney's performance ability is really something. I love that number. Everything about the Little Johnny Jones section. I love Mary. The song Mary,
oh,
I think, is such
is gorgeous.
A beautiful tune. Beautiful tune. For it was Mary, Mary, plain as any name can be. It's just such a beautiful ballad. That. It's one of the, I don't know, I can't even put my finger on what it is, but it's such a melodic, beautiful tune.
Well, and it's so simple too, and then the way it's used in the movie, like, granted, since his wife character in the movie is a complete fiction,
yes,
from real life, but the idea is that her name is Mary, and so the idea is that he's written it for her. And then has to give it to, like, the Broadway star of the day.
Right.
So they can snag her for one of their shows. And how his wife is totally cool with it. Because it's like, Yeah. Sam called me a couple of... I knew as soon as you walked in, you gave my song away.
Yeah. I gave you a song to Faye Templeton tonight. I know. I don't think you heard me. I gave your song to Faye Templeton. Yeah, I know. I heard you.
That's the one thing, though. Now, I am blanking on the name of that actress who plays his wife.
Oh, Leslie...
Joan Leslie?
Joan Leslie.
Joan Leslie and Jimmy Cagney have such adorable chemistry in this movie.
It's maddening. The chemistry is maddening. And she was quite young. I think she was like 19 or something.
Seriously?
Yeah, man. Yeah. She was very young when they... Oh, 17. She was 17 when they did this movie. And she... No, wait. That's not right. Yes, it is. She was born in 25. So 42, she would have been 17. She... And they... You know, she meets him when she's about 17, when the character is about 17, and then they age her up, and they're an old, elderly married couple, and they put her in, you know, elderly makeup. They age her up, and she does it quite well. You know, she can act. It reminds me a little bit of in Captain America with Peggy Olson.
Even Peggy Carter.
By Peggy Carter, Peggy Olson. Oh my God, Mad Men. Mad Men. I have to take a drink for that now. But yes, Agent Carter, and how she did it. It was a similar thing where it's a young woman, you know, who plays old so well that you hardly can tell. Like, wait, where? How old is this woman? Because is she somewhere in the middle? Like, where is she? Joan Leslie was fantastic, and their chemistry is outstanding. It kind of makes you wish you'd seen more films with the two of them together acting side by side because they were so great.
Well, and also, once again, going back to the fact that I always thought of Jimmy Cagney as the gangster guy. Mm-hmm. And so his comedic timing in this movie, he's got that very sort of dry, you know, that verbal wit of, you know, like the beginning of the movie, it tickled me. It's like he's kissing his wife after the end of the show. It's like, don't bother me. And then his partner's like, we got a telegram from the White House. Ooh, that bothers me. and it's just that he has that timing that just goes beat, beat, beat. And that's what I love about like old movies from the 40s is that sort of snappy beat, beat, beat humor where the jokes just land right. And when you have an actor who can time that response and it just tickles you, even if you know the joke is coming.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, it does. In fact, for me, having seen this movie, I don't even know how many times, you anticipate and you look forward to the joke and then you still laugh at it. Like, here it comes, and there it is, and it's still funny. Some of those jokes just get me every time, every single time. And it's his timing and it's the writing and it's such a, the comedy in this film, I have to say, the gags, the jokes are a little bit ahead of their time, I think, because they have a little bit of a sarcasm that is not really, you know, of their era. It is a little bit something you'd expect. Some of the jokes feel a little more modern in how sarcastic they are.
Well, it kind of has I don't know why it just came, but it kind of almost has like an Abbott and Costello kind of timing to it.
That's true. Timing-wise, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, which works because you're dealing with actors who were supposed to have been vaudeville who then got onto Broadway, which, you know, you either went vaudeville Broadway or you went vaudeville radio. Those were kind of the two paths you took. And so it worked for the character. You could imagine a man who grew up in vaudeville who in his real life would have this kind of timing.
Right. That's right. Yes. Absolutely. And it speaks to like his talent as a performer, right? That he would have that comedic timing on stage and off. So yeah, absolutely. It totally fits. I love Mary, the character and the song.
I have to admit, I have a very soft spot for Harrigan.
Yes, me too.
Well, being Scotch-Irish, it just, you know, I just love going into the Irish accent. Harrigan, that's me.
That's me. Yeah. A double R-I.
A double R-I.
Is he saying W-R-I?
G-A-N-I-C. It's just, it's cheesy and corny, and by golly, I love it.
You know who else I love in this movie? Dietz and Goff.
Oh my goodness.
The two Broadway producers. Today.
That was your department.
That was your department. My junior partner will review that. So good. And of course, Oh shoot, what was the name of the guy that they went with? The chubby guy who ends up producing Little Johnny Jones.
Oh, he's German or, you know, yeah, or yeah, yeah. Something.
Well, I remember the actor's name, S.C. Zakal, but what was the character's name? It's driving me crazy.
The problem is he's one of those characters that I could care less what his actual name is.
Yeah.
I just love his, I want the Koeskas, on the dancing. You know?
He's a little bit of a problematic character in today's age, but he's delightful. In fact, that actor, his name is S.Z. Zakal, but his nickname is Cuddles. Like, he's always credited as S.Z. Cuddles Zakal, because he's such like a cuddly teddy bear of a man. I can't remember what his name was, but must you give it to Dietz and Guff? Must you? Well, we did promise it to Dietz.
Oh man, and you have to give some credit to the guy who plays Sam Harris.
Sam Harris,
because he is the straight man. Mm-hmm, he is not allowed to really be. The only time he's allowed to be funny is in that one scene where they form the partnership of Cohan and Harris, and he's really just playing off Cagney.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And they have a really good chemistry as well. Like they fit like a glove, the two of them. I mean, even when they form the partnership and they kind of con what's his name into giving them money to produce the play. It's sort of a delightful, charming, like, oh, these two guys just meet at a bar at a gentleman's club, not in the modern sense, but in the old sense. And they become partners for life as a result.
Oh man. And that's another one of those parts where the movie kind of whitewashes like why their partnership broke up, which, do you know the story behind that?
I don't actually at all. I never looked into it.
It was Actors Equity had just formed, and there was a strike in 1919, and Cohan found himself on the side of the managers against the actors. And he basically made a proclamation of he would not let the union into one of his theaters or he was going to leave the stage. That's why they broke up. He sided with the managers and the producers against Actors Equity, and he kind of lost. And so that he sort of self-imposed his own exile from Broadway because he just didn't like where the business was going with the union. And so he left.
So he took the side of the producers and the managers. So why did he have to dissolve the partnership? Was Harris on the side of the actors?
I think it wasn't really. I think the dissolving the partnership was just he wanted to leave Broadway.
Okay.
He wanted to completely unplug from Broadway, which is really how it's portrayed in the movie. Is that after his dad dies, he just doesn't have the heart for it anymore, and so if he can't be there as a functioning partner, well then the partnership can't exist if he's not going to actually be working.
Got it.
So that's how they kind of, you know, wave a little pixie dust over it in the movie, when in reality it was he went against the actors union and he kind of lost.
Interesting. Yeah, they completely skip over that completely. It's interesting. It makes you wonder how much of that was kind of common knowledge at the time. You know, was it like showbiz gossip that everybody knew, that like the common man knew, or was it something only showbiz people really understood?
I really think it was, because that was back in 1919, so that the movie's still coming out 30 years later. I'm sure nobody really knew about that. It's the same way that, like, I think it was who did that old Cole Porter biopic Night and Day. I'm trying to remember. It was like Cary Grant. I think it was Cary Grant who did it. And, you know, I think it's the same thing where, to make it appealing to the audiences, they just wiped over anything that the audience wouldn't have accepted at the time.
Right.
And
right.
That's one of those things where they didn't want to make Cohan's the hero of this propaganda piece. They don't want him to come across as crushing the little guy, which is basically what he was doing when he was like, nah, screw the actors.
Hey, guess what? You know, guess who directed Night and Day?
Who did?
Michael Curtiz. Guess who directed Yankee Doodle Dandy?
Michael Curtiz.
So there you have it. That's really funny. It's It's a really, really, yeah, it is whitewashed. You're right. And it skips over a lot of things. You know, we talked about how Cohan's wife, Mary, didn't exist in real life. But Cohan's real life second wife, who he was married to when the movie came out, she famously loved this movie. She went and saw the film. You know, they had a private screening or whatever, and she famously like loved it and actually kind of convinced Cohan, like, "Oh, George, it's so great. Like, you know, you have to sign off on it. It was so good. They did a good job with your life." And it's like, she knows full well that it's mostly, like, not mostly, but a good chunk of it's made up, because like she's not in the damn thing.
I really do feel like, however, Mary is more her than the first wife.
I have heard that. I have heard that, yes. That she's an amalgamation of the two, but more the second wife than the first wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can see her loving this movie, yeah, to be honest.
Makes sense.
With you.
It makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. But it is funny how they kind of, you know, gloss over some details. I mean, even to this day, right? That's what happens when in any film. You take the parts that are gonna make the best movie, that are gonna make the best story, and that people are gonna like the most. Certainly back then it was a little more about like, okay, what's the tearjerker and what's more heartwarming and that sort of thing. But nowadays it's like, what's gonna fit the narrative better, you know? It's the same basic idea.
Well, it hasn't changed. I mean, let's be honest, Hollywood hasn't changed.
No, so, certainly not.
No, not at all. But what it does lend to is just a beautiful story that, I mean, ends on something that I absolutely love, which is as Cohan is leaving the White House, and he does that tap number down the flight of stairs.
Yeah.
And that's just beautiful. And then, of course, you know, it ends on another song that I was not aware of, and this movie introduced me to, which is the song "Over There," which was a war anthem for World War One. That after I saw the movie, it's one of those things that once you hear it, then you suddenly hear it everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, because it was a big. It had a resurgence during World War II as well, which is why it was so poignant. You know, if you're watching this movie in 1942 in a movie theater, you know that song very, very well, and to have it end on that, and even to this day, I mean, I was born, 50 some odd years after this movie came out, and it still brings me to tears a little bit. It chokes me up at the end when he's walking out of the White House. He's won the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he finds this military parade and joins, and they're singing "Over There," and he's marching alongside them, and that one soldier's like, "Well, you know, come on, old timer, don't you know this song?" And he
the
just
dramatic
starts
irony of he's yeah. the one who wrote the song.
Right, you know? Right, right, exactly. And he's like, "Oh, it seems to me I do. Well, I don't hear anything." And he sings the song with them, and he's crying, and the audience is crying, and I'm like, "Is it dusty in here? What's going on?" Why? It's a beautiful ending. It's a beautiful it makes you love this guy who you didn't know 2 hours ago, and you're like, "Oh, you know, what a great story. America's a great place, isn't it?" It really gives you that patriotic feeling, very similar to the way I feel about like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know, it just gives you that like, "Oh, America's
it's a great
place."
It's very Capra-esque.
It is very Capra-esque.
It's the idea of this guy came from nothing. And it's that classic. I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps.
That's right.
And now I own Broadway.
Right. Right. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Because he was just a lowly kid born into a performing family. I mean, they were actors, but they weren't. It wasn't glamorous. You know, vaudeville was just. The actors were sort of like the bottom rung of society, and they were living in squalor. And he became, you know, he owned all these theaters and produced all these very successful shows and became this huge figure. I mean, he was, you know, a showbiz mogul, like you would see today, that found huge success.
Right, because he had the moxie to write his own stuff, star his own stuff, direct his own stuff, produce his own stuff, and when I gather was a very good self-promoter. which yes. you had to be at that time. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. it kind of just it's the whole package, but they make him very likable in the movie, which you could debate whether he was really that likable. But for the purposes of the movie, you can't help but smile because
exactly.
you just want him to succeed. And when he does leave Broadway for, you know, the 5 minutes of the movie that he's gone for however long he's gone, you're kind of sad because you're like, no, you should be back on the stage.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, exactly, exactly. You get very invested in him over the course of the film. Have you ever seen... So you talk about him being a great self-promoter, and we see that a little bit. You know, you have to imagine that for him to be as successful as he was and to go from that rags to riches path, that he would have to be a little bit arrogant. And do you remember that scene where he's talking to Eddie Foy?
And yes!
Foy doesn't realize that he's talking to Cohan. Eddie Foy was, for those who don't know, was another, big Broadway star of the time, who also wrote his own stuff and choreographed and danced and starred in his own shows similarly. They were kind of rivals, and the way this shows it, probably not true. Foy and Cohan run into each other, but they don't recognize or Foy doesn't recognize Cohan. He's like, oh man, this Cohan guy, you know, what a windbag or whatever, and he starts hurling insults without realizing he's talking to Cohan. And halfway through, you know, they kind of realize they're talking to one another and whatever. They make light of it.
Oh, yeah. And that was actually Eddie Foy.
It was Eddie Foy Jr.
Foy Jr., right.
Eddie Foy Jr. playing his father. But the funny thing is, have you ever seen the film The Seven Little Foys?
I have not, but that's the one where Bob Hope plays Eddie Foy, isn't it?
Bob Hope plays Eddie Foy. And so, Eddie Foy had seven kids and they were all in show business with him and all this stuff. But there is there's a scene in there where they're at like the Friars Club or one of those clubs that all the Broadway guys would hang out with at in New York. And Cagney reprises the role of Cohan.
I've never seen it, but I've heard of it because I went through a little Bob Hope phase in college. And I go through weird phases as a person, and I went through a Bob Hope phase, and I saw that. And I was like, that is so awesome that there was like a little mini universe where they kept the continuity of Cagney as Cohan.
Yes, exactly. It is a Cagney cinematic universe, Cohan cinematic universe. I'm sending you a link that you can look at whenever you have a chance, and I'll stick this in the show notes too. But it's a clip of the dance routine from that film where Cagney and Hope play Cohan and Foy, and it's fantastic. They do an outstanding job in it, and it's a whole lot of fun. I saw this movie several years later. This is 1955, so 13 years after Yankee Doodle Dandy, and whoever had the idea to get Cagney to do this was just absolutely brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Another thing worth watching, if you like Cagney in general, or really if you like old Broadway in general, the way I got to this was on the DVD of Yankee Doodle Dandy, there is a clip, and maybe this is on the Blu-ray too, you could tell me, there's a clip of Cagney accepting like an AFI, American Film Institute award, and talking about, you know, in part talking about Yankee Doodle Dandy and some other things. And you can go down a YouTube hole of just watching clips of old actors winning, because the AFI used to do like an award ceremony every year where they would give all these awards and a lifetime achievement award. And the most fun thing to do is just to watch all these old actors like Gene Kelly and Bob Hope and James Cagney and Cary Grant and all these old, you know, old guys, Jimmy Stewart, accepting their lifetime achievement awards. And they, you know, they get the podium for about 10 minutes or something. It's not just like a usual acceptance speech of like, oh, thanks so much to my wife and my producer and blah, blah. It's like they get to give a little speech for like 10, 15 minutes. And they're all delightful. Every last one of them, just to hear them talk about their careers in retrospect as old men and women. It's really, really cool. And Cagney's is one of the best.
No, I think I remember seeing something with the Jimmy Stewart one, and I'm gonna
Jimmy Stewart one's a good one too.
I'll have to just go down this black hole of these clips because this sounds like gold to me. Like this
is
the kind of stuff that I would just watch because I grew up watching these movies with these guys. I mean,
right?
I going back to the library story. I mean, that's what I would do. Is like if it was black and white, I was probably gonna watch it.
Yep. Yep, absolutely, absolutely. Those are the classics, man. And this movie, I think, is probably the best. It's different, right? It's not like a Top Hat or a I don't know, Singing in the Rain, or it's not like any of those. American in Paris, certainly, you know, it's not like a lot of the other classics, because it's framed in this device of, here's a showbiz guy and we're going to show you not just scenes from his life, but, you know, the shows and the musical numbers and the songs that, you know, that he composed. So it's not sort of like we're going to work these songs into a story and people are bursting out into the song on the streets. It's kind of all in a much more realistic way.
Yeah, it's not quite the MG. We haven't gone to the MGM musical.
Exactly.
Yet.
Yeah.
You know, we're
like Kiss Me, Kate.
No, we're not in Kiss Me, Kate. We're not in the Gene Kelly era of Brigadoon and Singing in the Rain and all that. No, we're still going to say, if they're going to burst out in the song, we're going to explain why.
It's because, like, they're on stage. They're not just bursting in the song. They're on stage performing a show. Right, exactly. I like that. There's something charming about that, because we're having a little bit of a hard time describing it because it's unique in that regard. I don't know of many other. I can't think of many other films that do that. There's so many songs. I want to name them all, but we're gonna run out of time here in a few minutes. What are some highlights? Just like a lightning round here, because we're already over time. But what are some highlights we should mention before we say goodbye?
Definitely 45 Minutes from Broadway.
Great one.
That's just a cute one. My 1-year-old crawled into my lap to watch that one with me last night, which was
so
just
cute,
adorable.
So great.
And this is the weird thing. He didn't write this. This was Kaufman and Hart, which is the show. They did a show called the I'd Rather Be Right. But the song that they wrote, that where he plays FDR off the record.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not a song Cohan wrote, but I still enjoy it because it's very snappy. I mean, if you know Kaufman and Hart, it sounds like a Kaufman and Hart.
To a T.
And you get the little bit at the end where he's like, we'll put ants in his Japants.
Yes.
And that's on the record.
On the record, yes.
Yeah, because it's like that we're going to go after the Axis.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so that's one of those songs I just love. And it's kind of funny because they talk about the show at the beginning of the movie, but you don't get to see the show until the end of the movie.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And it comes full circle, right? Because it starts at the end of that performance, and then it takes you all the way up to, like, it goes from the moment he was born, then all the way to the moment that the movie started. And it's like, and that's how I got here. It is a really well done device. And yeah, you get that sort of, it's teased at the beginning, and you don't actually get to see it until the end of the film.
So I feel like every other one that, I mean, because we've talked about so many of them already. We've talked about Harrigan. We've talked about Mary. We've talked about Give My Regards to Broadway and Yankee Doodle Dandy, Grand Old Flag, Mary, Off the Record, 45 Minutes from Broadway. I mean, it feels like you're just naming every song in the movie at this point.
It kind of does, yeah, because they're all so great. Oh, you know what I really like? I like that medley of all the stuff after the war, where it goes.
It's basically the 20s. It's basically showing.
He is the man who owns Broadway. That's what the daily papers say. Oh, I forget. Malone? Bobby Malone?
Molly Malone.
And then
there's
I
Nelly.
I love the name Billy. My dad's was the same Billy. They do medleys really well in this film. You have that one, and then you have the Cohan's medley from earlier in the film when he's growing up, where you've got I was born in Virginia and all those other songs.
Oh yeah, there's one that didn't. That's one that doesn't age well, by the way.
No, it really does. Oh, the minstrel show. Yeah, the blackface stuff does not age well at all.
No.
That's one scene that really. The music is so of its time and really paints a picture of that late 1800s, early 1900s time. And then, of course, at the end of the I Was Born in Virginia tune, you have the one of the most famous lines in the whole movie, which is, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you, which apparently was something that Kohan would say quite a bit. That was sort of the way that the Kohans would sort of sign off and end their act when they became a very successful, famous vaudeville act. That was very popular in their touring days. And then that comes back when his dad dies and he goes through the whole, he says it again and just, ugh.
And then he says it to President Roosevelt when he gets the medal.
Yes, like, that's right.
Oh, that's the line I remember from this movie. It was so funny, is as we were tweeting last night as I was watching it, and then you tweeted that at me. I was like, of course you did. Because that's the line from this movie. If there's that tagline or that memorable line, that is it. You say that to anyone, and if they've seen this movie, they know what you're saying.
Absolutely. It's the most distinctive line, I think. If you've seen this movie, it's like the "May the Force be with you" of this movie. It's like the code phrase to say, I've seen that movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, totally. Oh man, there's so many classics. It's such a great movie, and I think gets better the more you watch it, and the more the music. If you're a musical theater person at all, you owe it to yourself to watch this, because it really is ingrained in the history of musical theater, and it's just plain fun to watch because the numbers are so good, the story is good, it's funny, it's heartwarming. It kind of does it all.
Well, and it also, it's one of those things that if you love crooners. So many of these songs most crooners, and I'm a huge Sinatra fan, and so all those crooner songs were almost always Broadway songs that got jazzified.
That's right.
And so this is just another one of those movies where you can go, this is where those songs came from, and this is what these songs originally sounded like.
Right.
Going back to your whole, I remember it the first time I heard it. This is not the way I remember it.
right. Yeah, exactly. If you're used to, if you're used to a Sinatra version of really just about any song, you're going to, when you hear the original, you're going to be like, that's not quite right, though, is it? There's something off here. And it's these, to me, these versions of these songs, because they're how I know these songs to begin with, these will always be the definitive versions to me.
Oh, absolutely. And there are a handful that if it hadn't been for this movie, I never would have heard them. And Mary and Harrigan, these are the versions I hear in my head. I will never be able to hear Harrigan without a cheesy Irish accent. It's just how it's going to be.
So true. It's exactly right. Exactly right. It's funny. My dad had, because he loved this movie, had bought a record at some point in '60s or '70s of songs of George M. Cohan, but it was some guy, I don't know who, singing all these songs. Not anyone particularly famous. It was just a generic record that just said greatest hits of George M. Cohan or whatever. And here's this guy, and he's singing songs like "So Long, Mary," "So Long, Mary, Mary, we will miss you so." But he's a dude singing it. All the parts that Mary sings in the show, he's singing both the men parts and women parts, and he's flipping the gender pronouns in a weird way that doesn't make sense. But you are a guy, and you're singing as if you're Mary, and you're just sing it the original way. Why did you even bother?
I don't understand.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's one of those. And especially when I was seven, I was I'm very confused. What's happening? Because that doesn't even make sense. This doesn't even. I don't like that. That doesn't even. I don't, dude. No, you're confused. You're doing it wrong. It's very funny. But more so, his performances were so, different than what I was used to that I was like, no, you're supposed to talk sing it. Why are you actually singing notes there? That doesn't, what? There's no notes. There's just talking. Hurry right away. No delay. Go today. It's supposed to be like that. Anyway, I digress. Scott, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for geeking out about this, classic film that has now become kind of obscure. But I really appreciate the chance to talk about this because I don't get to talk about this stuff very much. Tim knows his musicals, knows his Broadway, but this one's a little obscure and a little off the beaten path in this day and age. So I really appreciate the chance to get to talk about this with you.
Oh, Well, I appreciate you inviting me. It was an honor. It gave me an excuse to watch the movie again last night, which I'm always up for an excuse to watch an old movie. And anytime you want to talk about old movie musicals, trust me, I have probably seen it and probably own it as well. This is one of those throw me, oh, Brother Bear, don't throw me in that briar patch. I am more than happy to do this anytime, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Anytime, man. Hey, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on podcasts and the internet and everywhere else?
Well, if you want to talk to me, you can find me on Twitter at ScottDC27. As Frank mentioned at the beginning of the show, I am one part of the Suicide Squad cast, where we talk about DC movies, television, and comics, mainly focusing on the movies. But we do have a whole network of the Suicide Squad cast network. You can find us at Suicide Squad cast on Twitter, Facebook, Patreon, and YouTube.
Awesome. Awesome. And those, you guys really do a great show. You guys are, you know, covering everything having to do with DC so thoroughly. I really enjoyed your Justice League episode. It was, you know, Tim and I and our friends Damon and Dan went to see Justice League together, and when we came out of the movie, we were like, all right, and when does the Suicide Squad cast episode come out? I'm not blowing smoke. I'm dead serious. For like, we were discussing it. We got a beer after the movie and talked about it, and we were like, well, I want to hear what, you know, Scott and Tim and Brett think, like, because it's a polarizing film, and I wanted to hear what your guys' take was on it. And I was very satisfied with your episode, and as I always am. So, you know, keep it up, because it's always fun, and it's always good to have you here. And you know, you're welcome back anytime.
You're Tim. It's always weird when you have my Tim and your Tim.
That's right, yeah.
We share Tims. Like
Tim
I said,
and Tim Prime.
Yes, exactly. When it, always ask, I mean, just ask, I will show up with bells on. But that's what I have to say.
All right, well, I'm going to hold you to that. In the meantime, thanks everyone for listening. You can find us on the internet at beerwithgeeks.com or at beerwithgeeks on Twitter, beerwithgeeks@gmail.com, patreon.com/thoughtbubbleaudio. And of course, Thought Bubble Audio is the place where you can find this show and Supergirl TV Talk and Academy Rewind and Hate Watch with us and all the great shows that we make at Thought Bubble Audio for your perusal, enjoyment, etc. Scott, thanks so much for joining me once again. And until next time,
cheers.